Okay, so welcome those most desperate listeners to the last talk of this winter school, which is, I should say, was so beautifully organized, and it was a real pleasure to address this audience, so curious and so energetic. Today I'm going to complete the proof of the Babylon accumulation theorem, and I recall the problem that we are facing. We had considered polycycles, just separatrix polygons, and studied the first return map of some cross section, which was initially defined only on a positive semi-interval and not necessarily analytic at this point. We proved in one of the previous lectures that this map, if written in the logarithmic chart z, which is minus logarithm x, takes the form the following. Delta is asymptotic to a series of the form z goes to alpha z plus beta plus sum of exponents times p nu z, where p nu are polynomials and nu are infinitely many real exponents which accumulate to infinity. Well, in fact, one can say a little bit more about this set of exponents. They form finitely many arithmetic progressions, but this is not essential for our purposes. And alpha is positive, beta is real, and nu belongs to this set nu, which is a subset of real numbers. So what is important to know about this series is that the exponents here are real. But this is description of the asymptotic behavior of the function. Now, where this asymptotic behavior is valid? This asymptotic behavior is valid in some domain, which is called sometimes standard parabolic domain. And this domain can be considered as a image of the vertical half plane, say, real part of z greater or equal to zero, by a map of the following type. Z goes to z plus some constant square root of 1 plus z. So this is slightly less than half plane, because you take almost identical map and add to it something which as z goes to infinity is only of square root order. So it's this term is smaller considered to this, and so it is just slightly distorted half plane. I recall our goal is to show that the difference delta of z minus z, which I do not say by phi of z, can have only finitely many real zeros. And I recall where is the principal difficulty. So almost 100 years ago, the proof of this fact was going like this. Take the first leading term of this asymptotic series. Well, you can do this because as you go along the real axis, all terms in this series, which are basically monomials of the form z nu e to zk e to minus mu z, all of them are comparable to each other. So if you take two monomials of this form, then one will be eventually stronger, growing faster than the other. So whatever, you can introduce a linear order between all monomials in this series. And if you take the first one, the leading one, then it will eventually overtake the rest. And therefore, since every such monomial is non-oscillating, and here is important to notice that this is because all the exponents are real. If the exponents would be non-real, then we would have sines and cosines, which are oscillating functions which have zeros, so no domination, no overtaking, nothing. But since everything was real, then you can always choose the turn which will be A, non-oscillating, and B, dominating the rest. And clearly such term, you can write then such function as the leading term times 1 plus O small of 1, and such function doesn't have zeros accumulating to infinity. So this was the argument by Dirac, which held water until about mid-80s. Then several people recognized that this argument is faulty for one simple reason. First, we don't know whether this series converges or not. In many cases, it may be diverging. And in any case, this series, even if it does converge, does not converge to the function itself. Because the function may have theoretically some exponentially, super exponentially small decaying things. So it might happen that in general, if you ignore the rest, it may theoretically happen that this series is identically z. So this, the asymptotic series for this function is identically zero. But this function is non-zero itself. Well, in such cases, people talk about flat functions. Functions flat at infinity. They decrease very fast, but still there are non-zeros. And since you cannot control flat terms, which do not... We can say something about non-oscillatory behavior of non-flat terms of this type, but we absolutely do not know what happens with the flat terms. So, for instance, it may be oscillating or non-oscillating, we do not know. However, today I will try and convince you that if we know that our function is analytic in such of domain of such form, then any flat function which decays faster than any exponent, and that's the condition, otherwise we would see this function here in this expansion, any such function must be identically zero. So this is some kind of a general fact from the complex variables, which is closely related to the maximum principle. So the next few minutes I will talk about basics of functions of complex variable, so maximum principle. So this principle states the following. If you have a complex plane, a domain in it, and a function f holomorphic in this domain, well, you may think about Jordanian domains bounded, some even piecewise regular functions, arcs, and if you have a function which is holomorphic in this domain and continuous on its boundary, then this function takes then the modulus, the absolute value of this function, takes its maximal value somewhere on the boundary. So this is an analytic statement which can be translated in the geometric forms as follows. As you know, any holomorphic function defined in this domain will map this domain to its image also on the complex plane of another variable. So if I write W is f of z, then it would mean that I take this domain and consider its image. This application can be, sometimes it is conformal, and then it's, the behavior of such maps is more or less clear. But it may be not conformal. For instance, the boundary of the domain can be self-intersecting. And so the image of this domain is something which is covered several times. What the maximum principle says geometrically is that though this application is geometrically non-trivial, still the image of this domain is bounded by the image of the boundary. So if you take only this curve and look at its image, here it goes. Then what is you get in the image is bounded by the image of the blue curve. So what does this formulation preclude? It precludes the situation when the image behaves like this. So here is the image of the domain, and here comes the image of the interior. This cannot happen. This is the geometric prohibition which explains how holomorphic maps act on things. Now, the condition that F is continuous up to the boundary is important, and you cannot avoid it, cannot easily ignore it. Just one simple example. Consider the function which, well, counterexample. Consider the circle like this, so it's built on the segment 0, 1 as on the diameter. Well, it's not very symmetric, but nevertheless, so this is the z-plane. This is the circle which I decided to draw in blue. And consider the function f of z is exponent to 1 over z. Okay. Right, right. So this function, of course, it has a singularity at the origin, but otherwise it is non-singular. So it is holomorphic inside. Of course, it is not continuous on the boundary, because here we do have a strong singularity. But still, is it true that the maximum modulus principle holds for this example? No. If I take the map 1 over z, then this map, z goes to 1 over z, then this map will make me this circle into the half plane, the right half plane. So w is 1 over z. And my function in u chart will become f of w is simply e to w. So this, the boundary becomes the imaginary axis. And everybody knows that the function e along the imaginary axis, e to is, it's just cosine, modulus of e to is is equal to 1 as s is real. So we see that this function has modulus identically equal to 1 on the circle, yet, of course, unbounded inside. So you cannot ignore the condition that f is continuous up to the boundary. Still, you suspect that this behavior is caused by the fact that f is unbounded in principle. So if we would look like to have things such as this, then you just have a pinch in the surface which goes to infinity. The partial remedy in this case, how you can try and save the maximum principle in this case, it turns out that you can assume certain growth assumptions. If you assume growth assumption near this point, then you can restore the maximum modulus principle. So this is what was discovered by Fragment and Lindelof in 1908, is the following, that you can have such misbehavior only if your function grows sufficiently fast near the boundary. If the growth is sub-exponential in some precise sense, then such a phenomenon would be impossible and the maximum modulus principle could be saved even in for functions which are unbounded in the circle. So I will actually prove this result not in the case of a circle, but rather it is more convenient technically to work in sectors. So this point will be infinity. Well, that's convenient for many reasons. And we shall deal with sectors of opening argument of z is less than p over 2 alpha, where alpha is some positive constant. So 1 over alpha is the opening of this sector measured in radians. And so we'll deal with functions defined holomorphic in S alpha. So this is sector S alpha. And we suppose that F does not exceed certain constant M on the boundary, which consists of the two arrays here. Well, as I said, I am interested in what's going on around infinity, so forget about what's going about near the origin. The theorem by Fragman-Lindelöf is the following. Suppose that the function f grows no faster than sub-exponentially of the following form, exponent z to beta, where beta is some number smaller than alpha. So the growth characteristic, the growth estimate, depends on the opening of the sector. The wider the sector, the more, the less stringent this estimate becomes. Of course, positive. Then F satisfies the maximum principle, F less than M in S alpha. Yes, of course, it is continuous up to the boundary, so we have a boundary which carries only one singular point. This point is at infinity, and we control the growth of the function as you approach this distinguished singularity. Then it turns out that if you have control of this type, then the function is bounded. Okay, so actually there are too many parameters that may confuse people. You can always assume or normalize the situation. So consider the application W, which is Z to alpha. This is a holomorphic map which has a uniquely defined real branch here. And what does this map do? It opens you the sector to become a half plane. So basically, this means that if I make this transformation, I will get a function defined on a half plane and bounded along this. So here, what this assumption would say to me, then the function alpha would become 1 in such a situation. P over 2 alpha, so it would, after such shearing transformation, you would get a half plane with alpha equal to 1. So what it would, this assumption would say to me, that the growth is less than exponential, so it will be still the same beta, but beta should be less than 1. So if it is beta is equal to 1, then it is an exponential bound, and if beta is less than 1, then the bound is sub-exponential in some sense. So you need, in some sense, you need to grow slightly less fast than the usual exponent, and the less fast doesn't means that you need here not the constant here, but rather less than one exponent less than one here. Okay, the proof of this theorem is not very sophisticated. So you achieve it by doing, okay, proof. Or maybe I will just call it an idea, sketch of a proof, idea of the proof, is the following. If I restore the initial situation with alpha, so what I do is I multiply my function f I replace it by f of z times the exponent which is intermediate. So I take minus epsilon z to gamma, where gamma is between alpha and beta. So in this case, it will be another sub-exponential bound which overtakes a little bit the growth estimate, but still will be decreasing in the right half plane. If you have a sub-exponential estimate and beta is smaller than 1, then still you can increase a little bit beta, and it will still be closer than 1, but this function would do a dirty job for you. So what does this multiplication do with your function? It does to it the following nice thing. First, because gamma is still between alpha and beta, it will be bounded along the rays of the angle. On the other hand, because gamma is more than beta, bigger than beta, it would kill the sub-exponential growth here. So that in practice, you eliminate the singularity into infinity. And for instance, this means that if I draw a large circular arc here, then as I shift the circular arc closer to infinity, this function denoted by g will tend to zero on this arc, and so eventually it would become less than m. Now, of course, but then this means that I well, this domain is already finite, so I can apply the maximum modulus here. I'm just so in this picture it will be like taking a small arc here. So to this remaining domain, I can apply the maximum modulus principle and conclude that the maximum modulus is achieved on the boundary. And this is valid for all epsilons. So now as I fixed this arc and let epsilon go to zero, I see that this term converges to identical one uniformly on any finite sector. So once again, this is a standard game in complex variables when you use non-uniformness of convergence. So you first kill the singularity and then make the killing force going to zero uniformly over a fixed compact subset. Then it goes to one. And therefore, you see that since you had maximum principle valid for all epsilon before zero, it will be also valid for zero, and this proves that the function is not exceeding m. So more or less standard trick in the theory of complex variables. Okay, now let me go back to this series. And see what can I do from it. Well, theoretically, in order to, I would like to apply some kind of maximum principle and see, and using this maximum principle control, for instance, the remaining term, the flat term, to prove that it is zero. Okay, let me just do this. I first would argue as if my claim is the following. If function f is holomorphic in omega and decreases, of course it will be continuous on this boundary, that's clear. And what is important that decreases to be certain faster than any exponential along the real axis. Well, decreases faster than any exponential. It was abbreviated before as flat. So if your function is holomorphic and flat on the real axis, then in this case, f is identically zero. So once again, this is a theorem very much in the spirit of Fragment-Lindelöf principle. And, well, it is proved, what happens if, if omega is simply C plus, the positive plane, then we simply consider, in this case, as I said, alpha is 1, what is important, and we can actually play a little bit more subtle game. So what we know that for any we replace f by f times exponent of z over epsilon, where epsilon is a small parameter close to zero. Okay. So this exponent on the real axis has modulus 1. As epsilon goes to z, if my function f was decreasing faster than any exponential, which means that f of z is less than exp minus m z, as z is real positive. And of course, for any m, there exists a constant such that this decay, exponential decay, happens. So if I have the function which decreases faster than any exponential, then of course the product of it by a fixed exponential will be still decreasing faster than any exponential. Okay, so this function is therefore subject to Fragment-Lindelöf, and the boundary is the maximum modulus of this function is achieved somewhere on the boundary. So we see that f of z uniformly in C plus is less or equal to m, which is some constant, its maximum values on the boundary, times e exponent to minus z over epsilon. Now, for any specific z, you simply let epsilon go to zero, and this would converge to zero. This is a negative exponent. Well, it's essentially the same trick. You kill the singularity. Before you kill singularity by multiplying by sufficiently flat function, here you show that your function is in some sense identically zero for any epsilon, and this implies that f of z is equal to zero for any fixed z. So this formally completes. Now, this argument was as if I was living in a half plane. I don't live on a half plane, I live only in the standard quadratic domain. But actually, because this standard quadratic domain is biholomorphic to the half plane by this map, nothing changes in my constructions. So if I know that it is true for the half plane, then I know that this construction also goes true for the quadratic domain. Okay, so formally I could stop here, but I feel some unsatisfaction. The last time I tried to explain in geometric terms why the correspondence map for the extends analytically for to some quadratic domain. The correspondence map for a single resonance saddle. So I felt that it was the explanation was not satisfactory enough. So today I just in the remaining 15 minutes I will give an analytic proof of these facts. Well, give a formal construction which may be a little bit more formal, in the sense that I'll write more formulas on the board, but would involve less drawing two-dimensional surfaces in four-dimensional space, which is okay, which may frustrate people. So what is my task? I have a, now I just recall the situation. So I have a differential equation near a saddle singularity, which means that I have a vector field and coordinates x and y. And this coordinates, this vector field says that x dot is equal to x 1 plus something, holomorphic terms. Okay, I write it off of 1 in order to be consistent. So this is a holomorphic O of 1, and y dot is equal to minus lambda y 1 plus O of 1. Again, this is holomorphic, depends on x and y. And lambda here is a positive number, so the second coefficient, the ratio of the eigenvalues is negative real, which means that I am working with a saddle. And the reason why I put x and y outside of the braces is that my coordinate axes are themselves invariant curves for the saddle. I know that they exist. I know that they're a real analytic, so I can rectify them and choose them as the new coordinates. And as a result, I get the situation like this. Now, my goal is the following. Consider a cross-section, x equal to 1, the initial cross-section, and y will be a coordinate on it, y on this cross-section, gamma 1, coordinate. I choose a point here with initial value y, and look when, or more precisely, where this orbit crosses the second cross-section, which is given by the equation y equal to 1. And of course, on this cross-section, x variable is a local coordinate. So here you see a source of confusion, because x and y are used sometimes as independent variables, sometimes as local coordinates. I could introduce more notation, but it will be probably even more confusing. That's why I don't like this kind of explanation in public. But, well, unfortunately, sometimes you have to do this. Okay. Then I have the function x is, say, w capital of y. I get a function which shows me what will be the x coordinate of the point of intersection as a function of the initial altitude on which you start. So, and this is the correspondence. So, what I need to show is the following claim, which is actually the second assertion here, is that I can extend this map, which is initially defined only on the positive real interval, into some holomorphic domain, some quadratic domain. Now, as I said, I prefer to work in the logarithmic chart. So if I introduce the chart z, which is minus logarithm x, then my differential equation, I can write it in the form of a non-autonomous lambda differential equation of the following type, just let me not confuse you anymore. One plus O of one, lambda y. So what happens is, it was as if I would be dividing this equation by this equation. So in the initial chart, I would have denominator x here. Just, this over this I would have. But since I'm using the logarithm chart, dx, dz will be dx over x, so one x disappears. And I get this equation, which is roughly the equation, almost like an equation with constant coefficients, so it is an equation for the exponent, eventually perturbed by some terms which are smaller than infinity. Now, what do I do? How I can describe for this equation? So here is my half plane, C plus, and I need to describe on this half plane my transition map, my correspondence map. So for this, I should do the following. I should consider this equation with Z varying in this half plane, and I need to find a solution of this equation. I denote it by Y of Z. Y of Z such that first is solution of this equation, second it hits at certain moment the right transversal, which means that W of Y of Y is equal to 1, which means that at the moment, at some moment y, it hits the point y, the upper transversal, and I need to find out where do I start. So I need to take this the solution of this equation for any y. Okay, wrong idea. So I put here delta. And then I need to evaluate this equation to the point corresponding to the initial launch point. So here x was equal to 1, but x is now the logarithm of 1 has infinitely many values. So I need to find the value of this solution anywhere on this integer lattice 2 pi I z. Right? So suppose that, y 2 pi I z is exactly delta of y. I claim it, this. Indeed, if we start the solution with this initial data and we continue it to some point y, in general, well, initially it was real, but we want to extend it to the complex plane, right? So we need to find an equation which starts from this point and hits the entrance cross section. Well, once again, this is a little bit counterintuitive. Think for a second about what I say. So we need to, we are specified the entrance condition, the exit condition, and the value of the function when you go forward is specified by the value of the corresponding solution at the entrance point. Well, just think a few seconds that I'm not cheating. No, everything is written here, and I hope I did not mistake. I didn't make any mistake. Okay, so if you agree with me that we need to find, in order to construct my map delta, I need to take a solution of this equation. Normalized by, if I want to define it at a point y, I need to take the point y, take the solution of this equation normalized by the condition, by the initial condition that it is equal to 1, and then extend it to one of those points here. Why to one of those points? Because the same solution, as I explained the last time, has the same leaf of defoliation, the same holomorphic curve, cuts infinitely many times this transversal. So we don't have a single a uniquely defined correspondence map. It is multivalued, and of course I am talking about an analytic extension of a certain branch. So we can choose any of those points for the extension. Now, it is relatively easy to see that, well, what happens with solution of this equation? So they decay as we go forward in Z. So if we go backwards when the real part of Z decreases, probably minus lambda W. Okay. Let me check if I did not make any error. So when I try and construct solution of this equation extended along a horizontal axis, because of the sine of lambda, I get an exponential decay. Okay. Before I make this extension, just one remark. So it's clear that this guy is defined everywhere, and so you can construct solution of this equation just by analytic continuation along any path. So what's the problem? The problem is that this term is defined only on the disk of size 1, because all our study is local. And so in order to continue solutions of this differential equation, we need to follow carefully that y never grows outside of the unit disk. Then we just don't have the equation anymore, so we cannot continue. So you cannot use absolutely arbitrary disks. So if we continue solution along this path, then here we started with absolute value to 1, then it would arrive to some exponentially small quantity. Because of the subtle nature, probably I made here an error like this should be, because of the minus sign here. So when you go like this, the value decreases. And therefore, it is very safe to extend solutions along horizontal axis. But unfortunately, if you do like this, you obtain another branch of the correspondence map, which is not the branch which was the real solution. So for the real solution initial, which you see on this picture, you take a point here on the real axis, and you have to continue it along the real axis. And then everything is very, very smooth. You see no problems. It goes exponentially small. And so this continuation is well-defined. So in order to obtain the analytic continuation of my initial real branch, you need to choose not just one of those horizontal points, of those points on the lattice, but this very same point at the origin, corresponding to the specific choice of the logarithm of 1 here. And, this means that after you continue horizontally like this, which is very safe, you have to continue along this axis, right? And this process is already not so much safe, because here what you do is you iterate, on the initial picture here, you go several times, continue along the unit circle. So in practice, this means that you iterate the holonomy map. And the holonomy map is corresponding to this stuff. It is tangent to identity. So in the first approximation, it looks like rotation. And so you might think that you can iterate, you can rotate any number of times, and you never escape the unit disk. But the nonlinear effects, which are present here, say that this is not exactly the linear rotation. So it is like after one iteration, the radius modulus of y will go to modulus of y plus o of modulus of y square. y. So it is it adds to the absolute value something of quadratic order, which means that you can iterate only for finitely many times safely, and then you lose control. Which in practice means that there is a relationship between the exponential squeezing, which places you safely very close to the origin, and then you iterate, you are allowed to do this only finitely many times until this small impact accumulates and starts outweighing the exponential squeezing here on this interval. And so you can count the distance of this, and therefore there is a restriction between the imaginary part of this point and the real part of this point. The real part should grow to infinity if the imaginary part also grows to infinity. And if you want to be specific, you can, of course, easily calculate the impact of one slow stretch and the impact of the exponential squeeze, exponential contraction here. And once you calculate things, then you see that in order to safely remain in the unit disk, the shape of the domain to which you can extend your map is a quadratic domain. So it's qualitatively, it's clear that you have to increase the real part with the imaginary part, and so the accurate analysis explains that it is sufficient to take just quadratic tangency. So I hope that for those who didn't understand the previous explanation, this one little bit more formal and in some sense more elementary would look like. But again, this is the same idea, that iteration of the holonomy map around the stable manifold is almost a rotation which almost preserves the unit disk, but not exactly, so you cannot iterate it in an uncontrollable fashion. Okay, so as I promised, I gave the proof of the finiteness theorem in this specific case when all points are elementary. All points are hyperbolic saddles. So one last remark. So where we are on the general picture. So what remains to do to prove it in the general case? It turns out that there exists a very powerful technique called desingularization, which was to some extent known already to Poincaré and Bendixson, but whose full power was revealed only in the 20th century, which says that any isolated singularity, however degenerate, by finite number of blow-ups, can be reduced to one of the standard list of singularities, which are called elementary. And besides the non-degenerate singular points, which are all elementary, there is only one type of singularity, which is elementary but not non-degenerate. This is the singularity which is called saddle node, and I already plotted its phase portrait like this. So it has singularity. It has holomorphic invariant curve through this singularity, but in general only one. And all trajectories here are flat are approaching this point with a flat contact with horizontal axis. So the formula, the equation is x squared plus ax cubed, y dot is equal to minus y. So this is the formal normal form for such singularity. This formal normal form can be achieved by the same construction as I explained talking about the Poincaré-Dirac technique. But this formal normal form is not analytic anymore. And what is okay, such singular points can indeed occur as parts of the separatrix polygons. But what is essentially bad about those singularities is that if you compute the correspondence map along the corner, around the corner here, it will be flat, unfortunately. So the map in this case, delta of y, will be something like e to minus 1 over y. The same flat map, which, as we know, causes us lots of troubles in different things. And so the whole analysis based on calculations of asymptotics visible in some sense. This is exponential in the initial chart. So we used Dirac series. It involves exponents, but in the logarithmic chart. So in some sense, exponents over there are powers on this scale, finite powers. So here we do have super exponential asymptotics, flat functions, super powers. Do we have still super powers in this world? Okay, and this makes the whole analysis immensely more complicated. And here, as I said, you need at least one of the two books to cover the story till the end, but this is definitely outside of the scope of this course. Thank you for your attention, for those who survived.